Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 3-Point Perspective Podcast. It's a podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
And I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. And we've all been working for about the past 25 years as children's book illustrators. And we've published somewhere in the neighborhood of about 50 books, I think, by now. And we've all taught illustration at universities.
That's right. And each week we're going to tackle a different subject related to illustration from our three perspectives. Sometimes we're going to agree, sometimes we're going to argue, but hopefully you're going to learn something each and every time.
That was great, Will. I'm glad you clarified that we've been working as children's book illustrators. And we've all been working as shift managers at the McDonald's. Drawing on the side. So
I try to make it sound natural, even though I have to read the notes.
Oh man, good radio people are, they're such pros when they read stuff. It sounds so natural. We're terrible.
You don't even know they're reading. I'm getting to that point though, because I've been reading notes and trying to make it sound natural, that I could spot it when someone's not, when someone is reading something, you know.
It's weird. It's such a subtle shift of their voice and their timbre.
It is. And you know, it's almost like acting. Like if you want to read something and have it not sound like you're reading it, you have to put on like your actor's hat and do a performance instead of reading it off of a card. Now, could you tell I read that entire thing off of a card? No, it just sounded like I was just
you're just a pro.
As I went. Okay. Do you think people want to listen to our podcast today?
No.
What we're actually going to talk about, or just listen
they
to
do
this?
Want to listen. They should want to listen because it's going to change their lives.
I think this episode could change some people's lives if they actually go and do it. Like I know a handful of people who have started doing conventions and now that's their main income. That's the thing that they do.
But yeah, it's pretty crazy. I guess we should announce that our topic is art fairs and Comic Cons.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, if they read the title, then they know what this one's about.
But I have to let you guys know that just the fact that they're listening to this did change their life because they're not listening or doing something else that they could have been doing.
Okay.
So that's just to put
Will's,
it
Will things. Is going well, deep right now.
You don't have to do a whole lot to change someone's life.
No. Well, you just have define to define change someone's life.
You just have to jump in front of them at the four-way stop to change their life.
Okay. all right. So do you want to take it away, Lee? This is your show today. You've got all the notes here.
I've got the reins. All right. Yes, I will.
So you go for it.
I wanted to do this one because a lot of people, well, I'd say a small fraction of people do art fairs and Comic Cons and make a pretty good living at it. And then I always talk to illustrators and future illustrators who want to do it, but they have literally no idea how to start or what that world is like. And so I thought it would be a good one to just start to talk about. We're going to show you guys some ways to get into the art fairs and Comic Cons. We'll talk about the differences, and really, there's a lot of opportunity there that that some of you guys might want to explore. I would highly recommend it because it's an easy way. And there's not too many easy ways to make money as an illustrator, but this is one of the fairly easy ways to make money. I should say that, I guess, with an asterisk, because there's a lot of conditions involved. Yeah. All right, so we're going to go over, I'll give you guys our topic. So we're going to go over an introduction to how all three of us got into it. We're going to talk about the differences between art fairs and Comic Cons. We're going to talk about where do you start? What's even the first step? Advice to the newbie. Then we're going to go over some horror stories and some success stories, and hopefully if we can get it all in, some gear and equipment recommendations, because this is a particular area that is kind of gear intensive right in the beginning.
Cool.
You guys ready to jump in?
Yeah, let's do this.
Yep.
All right. I guess I'll lead since it's my topic. So I'm going to be the art fair side of things. Jake and Will be the Comic-Con-ish art. Is that how you just call them all? Comic-Cons or
yeah,
just
Comic-Cons.
Cons?
Comic conventions.
Conventions.
Comic convention. Yeah.
Okay. So we'll get into the different.
Can I throw a curveball right at the beginning here?
Oh, man, you're going to mess up my notes. I'm not ready for any improv. Okay, go for it.
I think just to like, I was thinking about this on the drive to the studio today because I was looking at your notes. How much money, like what's the money range that you can make? Are we going to get into that towards the end of this or is that something you want to start with?
We are going to get into that. I had that kind of under success stories because that would probably be like, what's your best art fair? I will go ahead and say just as a leader, so you guys can listen to the whole thing. My best show is $24,000 for 3 days.
Okay. Because I wanted to lead a little bit with that just to say like, you know, this is all this work that you're doing for, you know, here's the upside. Here's what you can walk away with if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
So yeah. I would say the range, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say the range for me personally for Comic-Cons. The first one that I ever did, I had a half table and I made enough money to pay for the table and pay for my travel and for my stock. So I broke even. And then the most money I ever made gross at a convention, I think I broke $9,000. So that's the range. And I pretty much average when I go out and do one of these for a weekend, 5 or 6,000. So that's where it's at.
Well, I know Will is up there too. He's made a ton of money, upwards of what Will, 15, 17.
Our best show by far was Seattle this last year and right around 19.
Wow.
But it's a lot. Most of them aren't that high. Most, I think our average show is probably between 7,000 and 9,000, mm-hmm, somewhere. And that's gross. So that's not profit.
And right. We share the gross numbers just so that like, you know, what is possible, the amount of money that can flow into your account. And then it's up to you to like mess with all the variables to see how you can get your overhead as low as it can be.
Yeah.
You know, that's right. And that might be, you couch surf for the weekend, you know, maybe you stay with relatives if it's in a town that you have relatives in. I know one guy who does that. You drive to it instead of fly to it, things like that.
Yeah. We're going to get into all that stuff.
The thing I like about adding these to a freelance career is for me, I can speak for myself, that it allows me to say no to the freelance jobs I just don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's all that it adds is, you know, you make, you know, 1,000 or a couple thousand extra in a month and you can say no to something that would take you into a place you don't want to be. Cause I mean, let's face it, you only have so much creative juice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then I think that's a huge win.
Yeah.
So let's get down to the nuts and bolts of this.
So
let's dive in. Okay. So I was going to start out with how each one of us
Will,
got into it.
Can you just push mute for a second there? No, I'm sorry. Okay. Go Lee.
Shut up, Will. So we're going to get into how each one of us got into it. I don't know how, this will be interesting for me because I don't know how Will and Jake got into this. But for me, I was just living my life as an illustrator in Portland. And there was a show that my first one wasn't technically an art fair. It was kind of a mix between a convention and an art fair, I guess. And the difference is a market. We're going to go into that in a few minutes. But it was this convention called Crafty Wonderland, and it's in Portland every year. It's December around Christmas, and a spot just happened to open up, and I knew some other people who were on the board of it running the show, and I get this call like a week before the show saying, hey, do you want to fill this spot that opened up, because they have a blank space. And I had no idea what the whole thing meant. I mean, I didn't have anything really. So I said, yes, of course. And half my career is kind of that description. Like somebody asked me to do something, I kind of don't know what I'm doing. I jump in and try it anyway. So I rented a bunch of backdrops from the photography department at the school that I worked at and tried to, I mean, I really did tape, basically duct tape this whole booth together. It was an indoor show, thank goodness. And I was just hoping, I had a bunch of prints made, and I was just getting into the idea of selling prints online. So I had a stock of prints available, but not a ton. And I thought, I did have to pay for it. They didn't just say you can have this for free. I had to pay for my space, which I think at that time was about $500, $450, something like that. And I was hoping just to cover that and just make it an interesting experience. And by the end of the weekend, we had made about $8,000. And I sold some originals and I sold a ton of prints. One of them, I love this story, that somebody had seen a, maybe I shouldn't say this actually. somebody had seen a print and asked if I had the original available. And I had made the print digitally originally. And so there was no original. But I said, you know, I have that original at home and I'll bring it tomorrow. And so I went home after the show exhausted and I painted using my own digital print as the guide, painted the original in watercolor. And then I sold it the next day to that person. So that kind of helped pad it. But I was really interested. By the end of it, I met a bunch of cool people, had a bunch of great conversations, and I made a bunch of money all of a sudden. So then I went to, started looking for them, and there was a couple coming up in the spring. So I started kind of keeping my eye out for them, and I entered a few more. And the next one I made like 9,000, and the next one I made a little bit more. And so all of a sudden I'm like, all right, what is this all about? And that's when I kind of began my journey into this area. How did it go for you? How did it start for you guys?
For me, let's see, I was in my like mid-20s and I had contributed to a anthology book. A bunch of us young artists kind of got together and did this comic book where we each contributed a story. And then at San Diego Comic-Con, the guy who edited and put the book together got a table at the comic book convention, and he said, listen, I've got a table to sell the book. I've got extra space, so whoever wants to come down to San Diego can just have a section of this table and throw their stuff on it. And so for several years, I showed up to San Diego and I had like a little artist sketchbook that I was selling and maybe some prints. I can't remember early on, but just a couple of things to take up one little sliver of the table. And that's how I got sort of like the taste of what it was like to be at a comic book convention with very little, like zero overhead, just traveling out there, and I was going to go to Comic-Con anyway. And then, I got to see that, okay, people are interested. They're seeing this stuff. They're selling this stuff. And then there was a show called CTN Expo, which is an animation show, and it has a big artist alley component to it where artists can sell and share their work. And I got half a table, paid for half a table, and shared it with another artist. And that was the one where I pretty much broke even. I may even have turned a little bit of a profit. And that's when I realized, okay, so if I can do this good with half a table, let's get a full table. And the most I've ever had was like three tables in a row to sell stuff. And so that was sort of my journey from dipping my toe in to full on setting up, you know, have the huge banner, all of my artwork laying out there, and really a presence at the show.
How many years ago was that?
That was like my first half table. That was like 2010 or 11.
Okay, I just wanted to establish that because I don't think I said that as much. So you've been doing it for about 7 years. I've been doing it for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. Will, mm-hmm. How'd yours go?
I got into it because Jake made me.
Pretty much.
I saw my students having a lot of fun. My students from UVU, my art students, some of them were selling at the Salt Lake Comic Con. So I went up there and more just to poke around and see them. And I was like, how come I'm not doing this? And then with your prodding to do it, I was like, well, what do I do? And that took a while. And I think it was like a year later I ventured into it. And my first show was the disaster. I actually, rather than take time on this podcast really going through a lot of that, I made a YouTube video series. I think there's like 12 or 13 videos in the series that kind of document from that very first show up till now, and all the successes and failures and the amount of money I made, the amount of money I lost and different things like that. But basically the first show was a disaster because I had no idea what I was getting into, even though I had spent I went to two different shows and just looked around with the idea of maybe selling. There's no substitute for actually doing. And I think I would encourage my students all the time to do it, because I said, no matter what, even if you lose money, the lessons you will learn in actually getting ready for a show like that and having to get your artwork ready and having to make a display and having to interact with customers and, you know, all the mistakes you're going to make, you will learn more than you'll probably learn in a whole semester class at school, you know? So, and now it's become a big side business where I have an assistant that runs most of my shows. I think we're scheduled to do about 20 shows this year, and I go to maybe 3 or 4 of them, and he does all the rest and just brings me money.
That's a sweet gig. And then you give him a commission. Is that how that works?
Yeah, he gets a commission. He's worth it. We've been friends for 30 years. He's really good at doing it. And he, unlike just getting a warm body to kind of sit there and make a sale when someone wants something, he's active in promoting it. He does all the billing. He does all the tax information. He does all the contracts. He just does everything business-wise, so I don't have to touch it. So I pay him more than most people would probably want to pay an assistant, but it works for me because I can be completely hands-off, and it just becomes an extra source of income that doesn't really take much of my time now.
God, that's perfect. You're the only person I know who's doing it in that kind of a way.
I'm the only person who knows Wayne.
We all need our own personal Wayne.
Yeah.
I know a handful of people who've kind of divided up. They have a brand that isn't centered on their name as an artist. So it's more about, you know, the artist doesn't have to be there because people are more interested in the prints that they're selling than in that particular person. So what a couple of these guys, what they'll do is just have an assistant like Will, and then they can do 2 shows at the same weekend, and one guy's in this city and the other guy's in the other city.
Oh my gosh. My brain is exploding right now with ideas.
I know, huh?
Because we're going to get into how these shows are, but if you haven't done one, it's like Will said, it's worth it as an experience. You can't anticipate how much energy these things take, and they're really hard. And the idea of having multiple people be able to help you or even do a show while you're not there is so nice because you're dealing with a lot of people and you're dealing with a lot of gear and a lot of weight, and you're driving stuff around and the weather can be a factor.
You know, it's nerve-wracking when you drive to a new city that you've never been to and you're trying to figure out how to get into their convention center and like where you can put your car and it just like all the logistics and.
I know. And like, how do you get from the hotel to the place? Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many one-way streets I've gone the wrong direction on.
But you're only going one way, so that's legal.
That's true. But officer, I was going one way.
You can't go 2 ways at once.
But you know, I have to also say that.
That's a dad joke.
That's so bad.
As much of a pain as it can be, like if it were your only source of income, I wouldn't want to do that. I know some people do that. I personally would be I'd feel like my life was a little out of balance if I was doing nothing, because I know people that do 30 and 40 shows a year and they're just basically they live on the road.
Yeah,
I don't see how people do that.
Yeah,
I was talking with a guy at Denver and he's like, I have been home for 2 weeks this year so far, right? Yeah. We're 6 months into the year. And I think one guy even like, he just, I think he was Airbnb-ing his apartment out because he wasn't even there this whole time, which,
smart.
I mean, now he's making money off of his apartment that he's not even in anyway, you know? So,
oh my gosh.
I mean, the cool thing is you'll meet people you'll make friends. It's inevitable. If you do a bunch of shows, you'll start to see the same people. And like last time we were in Denver, we all went out to dinner together and it was like 20 of us mm-hmm. or 15.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. I didn't invite you. I thought Dominic invited you.
Well, yeah. Thanks. I was glad I was invited.
Thanks, Dominic Glover, for inviting us. But it gives me like some R&R in some ways, where we'll go to a city and it's like a real nice distraction to get out of the studio and actually be able to see and experience new things. Like next week we're going to Hawaii for the Honolulu Comic Con. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't started this. And we're just hoping to break even because it's expensive to get over there. We probably won't make a ton of money after expenses, but it will give us a chance to actually, we're taking our wives and we're just going to hang out and have a good time.
Oh my gosh. That sounds perfect. That's actually a good segue for us to get into the first real section of this. No, that's the second section. Sorry. Let's go ahead and start talking about the differences between art fairs and Comic Cons. Some of you guys may use those terms interchangeably, but they are definitely different markets. And it's important to kind of highlight the differences between them. Like I said, I work in the art fair market, and that is when you go to they typically set up like in parks, or sometimes they're in convention centers, but a lot of time they're just in parks. It typically during the summer or nice weather, there's those big tents everywhere, and you basically get a 10 by 10 foot booth. And it's mostly art that people are going to hang up. It's not a lot of collectors. It's nobody there is going to be interested in Batman or any kind of IP property that's already been developed. This is people looking for artwork, and they typically have a pretty good budget. The average patron is older, I'd say between 50 and 70. They have a lot of disposable income, and they a lot of times want to purchase originals. That is the one big difference, I think, in art fairs and Comic-Cons. Will and Jake can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just a little bit different of a market. It's tough to, like, they're not interested in character design or any of the things that we are just as illustrators. They're interested in art that's going to be hung mm-hmm. and framed.
They're interested in color palettes and textures and patterns. And yeah. if it happens to be an illustration that tells a story, that's like a bonus. May yeah. even be not a bonus. It might be like something that they're turning away from.
Well, it's a deterrent. I mean, I've had to learn my market the hard way just mm-hmm. over time, seeing what sells and what doesn't. And what I've noticed, one of the biggest differences between the Comic-Cons and the art fairs is that the more specific the story in my image, the less likely it is to sell. Mm-hmm. And so, the bigger the character is in an image, the less likely it is to sell. So a lot of times, a lot of the work I do is more environmental with a small little character in it. And I have just a very specific niche within the art fair market, in that typically people are buying for newborns and kids, and they're starting mm-hmm. They're rich people decorating kids' rooms. To put it bluntly, that's kind of how it works.
So like if you had an image of like a boy and a girl walking up towards, you know, a house made of candy, that would not sell as well as say like a tiny figure inside a bubble, and then there's strings attached to other bubbles and the bubbles are just flowing and it's flying through the air.
Right. Yeah. It's just kind of a whimsical feel. That stuff will sell a lot quicker than something that's super specific to a narrative story.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
So like, you know, but it's cool because I'm, you know, by giving you guys this podcast, maybe I'll have a lot more competition, but up to this point, I'm very, I have no competition or very little competition within the art fair, because most people are figurative painters, sculptors, they're doing abstract work or landscapes. And then I have this little micro niche of work that seems like it goes with kids' books, but it has a little bit more of an art kind of flair where it can be hung up on the wall without explanation. Mm-hmm. And I've lived in that little niche pretty comfortably.
You're going to show up to the next art fair and Will and I are going to be in tables right next to you.
I will say this, I've seen some other artists, illustrators try to get into it, but they don't understand that subtle difference of what mm-hmm. this market wants. And I sat next to this poor girl for 3 days at one of the art fairs, and people were coming into my booth and I was selling all this stuff. And I've got this super annoying cash register that every time I make a sale, it goes ding. You know, it has this. She was next
door. So you're like a Pink Floyd song over there. You can like, ching, 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 ching,
ching. It was just going off. And she didn't sell anything the entire weekend. She lost money. Oh, and her stuff was, in terms of illustration, was quite nice. But it just did not go with this group of people. Mm. So it's just important to know what the difference is.
I would venture to guess that you have you kind of tapped into what people like to hang in their house. And because when I look at your stuff, I actually kind of get jealous because it really does lend itself towards both illustration mm-hmm. and fine art. And I would have to make some drastic changes for mine. You picked a style somehow that like straddles two worlds really mm-hmm. easily. And the way that you're making your art, it's like you said, you strip it out of a story or strip the specifics out, and now it's got that decorative feel. But I would say you probably have a pretty good idea of what people are putting in their homes to be able to kind of go along with that vibe. Is that right?
Yeah. Honed over a couple of years of doing it and watching what sells, definitely kind of understand what they're looking for now.
Would you do something like come up with a really good image illustration, but then do color variants of it? So there's a green one, there's a blue one, there's a red one, there's a yellow one.
That's a good question. A lot of people do that kind of stuff there. And it's seen as normal. Like there's this one guy, he only paints barns. Just to give you an idea of this market, but he's really, really good at painting these barns. They're almost abstract, but there's a barn. And man, he's got 100 versions of this barn, some big ones, some small ones, blue ones and red ones and everything. And he does fantastic. They're really nice paintings, but he's really kind of doing the same painting over and over. And for me, I would feel guilty about that, but it's absolutely there for the taking.
I bet. So when he was younger, he went to a fortune teller and she said, in your future, I see you painting barns. And he was really upset about that for a long time until he realized, oh, I'm selling art.
Maybe I'll put a link to his work because when you say the word, you know, like he's just painting barns, that sounds so boring. Yeah. He's making them really nice. Some of these people are really good artists and they can make almost anything into this really evocative, like beautiful image. Hmm.
Well, one thing I've noticed with yours, Lee, is you do a lot of characters traveling or an animal or a person kind of riding a bike or flying machine or something like what is that like a common theme that you kind of were conscious of?
Yeah. I mean, I love travel so much. And a part of it has been sparked by these art fairs and traveling around. I just love traveling. So that's part of it. And that was my master's thesis in grad school is fantasy travel with pets, and I just keep going with that. But I'm going to give you guys I'll give you guys the secret sauce for what I'm doing for these art fairs, and it really is about creating a moment that people can interpret what's happening versus me showing them what's happening. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that makes sense. Like a lot of times illustrators really do hit you over the head with exactly what's happening. This person's getting kidnapped and there's a hero that's going to save them. And you can kind of identify these. If you just showed that painting to anybody who was unaware of the story, they could kind of piece mm-hmm. together this story. But I try to make it almost ambiguous where two people could view the same painting and come up with totally different stories. So I basically just kind of hint at an idea and right. let them solve whatever puzzle it is. And it's interesting because people bring their own stories to it. And I just love it because sometimes they'll be explaining what's happening in a piece and it's nothing like what the original reason I painted it. And sometimes I like there's better to
it's
be
almost,
honest.
It's almost like you look at something like James Jean's art and there's no discernible narrative to it, but it looks so pretty. And you know, he'll do a figure or a character or something, but it could be interpreted 100 different ways.
That's a good point. Yep. He's great too. And he's tapped into that market. He actually just painted a, if you guys don't know James Jean work, you should go look at it for sure. We'll put a link in our notes, but he did the exterior of a building in Portland and the budget on that was $140,000. So it shows you how his work transcends just being illustration and goes into this market that we're talking about here.
He's got over 700,000 followers on Instagram right now.
Yeah, we'll do another podcast episode on how to get your work on the side of a building. That's a
it's a very niche market.
A podcast for three people. An episode for three people.
Okay, so if that being how art fairs are, and that and the average buyer is looking for kind of what we just went over, what is the Comic-Con world? How does that differ? What do you guys think?
So, Will, do you mind if I
go ahead
take a stab at this, and then I want to hear your take on it. Comic-Con is pop culture through and through. And what it is primarily you're looking at people who have a spending budget of a couple hundred dollars, and they're going to divide that among five different booths, you know. So if you can get $40 out of a person, that's doing pretty good. That's a good average, you know, in the $30 to $40 range. What sells at Comic-Cons is anything related to a character that they already know and love. So any Marvel character, any Star Wars character, Harry Potter, Doctor Who, Star Trek, Lord of the Rings, anything anime, all of that kind of stuff sells. And we had our fan art issue or episode where we talked about, you know, shouldn't. And regardless of that, that's what sells at these comic book conventions in the artist section. The rest of the con, if you haven't been to one, is just a bunch of booths and tables selling T-shirts and stickers and buttons and collector's items and you know, keychains and stuff like that. And you can do. You could do okay doing that stuff too. You know, I know artists that will sell prints, they'll sell pins, they'll sell patches and stickers, they'll sell their own books. And I have a lot of success selling my books as well. And I've made four or five different sketchbooks collecting my sketches and artwork. And those will, you know, outsell my prints a lot of times at some of these conventions. So
it's a good thing to bring up in the products that you're bringing up are typically for the Comic-Con is between $5 and $50 or $5 and $70, would you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for art fairs, the difference, that's one of the differences I didn't really talk about, is that the average cost starts at around $50 and goes up to about $20,000 because you're buying originals. So that's a definite difference in between those two markets. So it's important to know that if you go to a Comic-Con, you're going to sell a large volume of, you know, the $5 to $70 stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a commission market in the comic convention, but it's, I want my character. I want you to do the character that I love doing something. And Jake, you do a lot of those. I don't do them because I feel like it takes me, I feel like they want what I'm selling in the print, and what I'm selling in a print takes me anywhere from 7 to 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to charge them what that time would cost. But some people are like Jake are really good at doing quick things that look really good.
Right. So I know some artists who will do.
I didn't want to make it sound like you can work for less, but you can because you're fast.
Right.
You're brilliant and you do great work. When I try to work really fast, I do crappy work. And then if I would be self-conscious of like charging anyone any money at all for what I would do in
that's the trick there with commission. So that is another element is when, see, people are coming to a convention, comic book convention, mainly for an experience. So, you know, maybe they're a cosplayer and they've been working on an outfit. So they come to show that off. Or if they haven't done that, they've come to see all the costumes that are there. If there's, you know, if they're a fan of Patrick Stewart, they've come to get their picture taken, you know, with him as, you know, because they're a huge Star Trek fan. If they're, you know, if they're a fan of Marvel, the Marvel movies, and maybe they're a particular fan of like Captain America, they have their Captain America shrine and wall at home. And so they're looking for things they can add to that, you know, another print or, you know, a cool Captain America sticker or statue or something like that. So they're coming there for that. Part of that is to like feed their fanness and also to have an experience. And where commissions fit into that is it kind of fills both. Getting a commission is an experience because usually they play a part in that, where they get to come up with the idea of what this artist is going to draw. And at the end, they have this, you know, this artifact that is theirs and it's unique only to them and no one else has this in the world. It's theirs. And so a lot of artists will just open up commissions either before the convention or during the convention. Sometimes I've done that where I'd say, okay, I'm going to be in Denver, you know, next month and I've got a commission list of 10 slots open. And some people will pay ahead of time and I might even do them ahead of time and then deliver that to them at the show. Otherwise, you know, Friday, Saturday, people will come up and say, is your list open? You know, I've got one or two slots open. What do you want drawn? And then I'll work when it's quiet at the table, I'll work on those commissions or I'll work at the hotel room at night on those commissions and then deliver them to them. And I could make an extra $2,000 doing that kind of stuff, $3,000, depending on what I'm charging.
I don't want to derail the conversation and go into these commissions too much, but I'm just flooded with questions right now about this market because I don't understand it at all. Mm-hmm. How much do you charge? And has anybody ever not liked the commission that you did for them?
So I started out charging about $40 or $50 for like an 8.5 by 11 drawing. Now I charge about $200, $250, even $300, $350, depending on the complexity of it, for a full 8.5 by 11, full color. Usually it's watercolor and marker ink drawing. Okay. And then I'll work with people. So someone might come up and how much are commissions? And I'll say my price and I can tell it's like outside of their budget. And I'll say, well, what is your budget for commission? And they'll say, well, I only have $60 or I only have $80. And I'll say, okay, well, I can do this for $80. You know, are you cool with that? And a lot of times they'll be like, yeah, okay. So it might be a half sheet and it might not have color. It'll just be line work or something like that. And the main thing is they want to walk away with an original. And you have some guys, some professionals that are doing, you know, $600 for a commission. And then you have, you know, $20 commissions. I know this one girl, she does so well. She spends, you know, the weeks leading up to a convention doing 100 of these tiny hand-drawn character drawings that are about a fourth of a 8.5 by 11 sheet. And she frames them all or she'll put them in plastic and she'll just do a bunch of, you know, anime characters or Star Wars characters or whatever. And you go there and I have one of Han Solo and Chewbacca and it was like $20. And I came back, you know, the last time I was at the same show as her and I'm like, do you have Boba Fett? Cause I wanted to add a Boba Fett to that. And she's like, no, I don't have Boba Fett. But that's what people do is they're like, I've got these, you know, I'm building a collection now of these original pieces of art. And that's one way that she's been able to figure out how to capitalize on people wanting their character and also wanting original art as well. I will say, going away from commissions, but a small percentage of my sales are also like my own IP. So what I've typically done in the past is I'll use fan art as the draw-in because people are walking by. They'll see, oh, there's Spider-Man. I love Spider-Man. What's this? What's going on? Or, oh, he did a robot Spider-Man. That's really cool. And they'll look at all my stuff, and then they'll see one of my original creations, Skull Chaser or Skyheart or something like that. And they'll be like, well, what's this? Oh, that's my original creation. Then I get a chance to talk about it. Whereas if they had never seen my Spider-Man drawing, they never would have stopped and come over and looked at my table. So I use that as like the hook. You know, 9 times out of 10, they're not going to buy a Skull Chaser print or a Skyheart print or something like that. But every once in a while, there'll be that 10th person that's like, this is my thing. I really like this. I want to follow this and see what, you know, what you're doing with this. And now I've got a fan, you know.
That is so smart. Because I hear a lot of people saying, oh, I'm going to switch from doing, you know, IP kind of characters to my own character. And that seems like certain death if you just cut it off like turning mm-hmm. off the faucet. And but you're saying basically lure them in with one thing, and then you've got the chance to kind of start getting your own work in there as well.
Right, right.
That's super smart. Pretty cool. All right. Can you guys think of any other differences between Comic Cons and art fairs? I mean, I think that's pretty much sums it up. Hopefully you guys have a clear.
Pretty what the was way that? People dress.
the lack of clothing on some certain people.
Yeah, at art fairs, do they cosplay as like Norman Rockwell or Picasso or
B. Arthur?
Yeah, B. Arthur.
I can tell you this, a little little factoid, that every commission, they do offer commissions sometimes to me at an art fair. If they look around my booth and they don't see kind of the specific thing they want, they'll offer to do a commission, and it's around the same cost as the original paintings that are hanging in my booth. Mm-hmm. And I can say this, that I haven't followed through with any of them. 100% I've dropped the ball on.
Mm-hmm.
Which is so bad, because I'll write down their number. I'll even take a deposit. Like the last show I did last year, I took a $1,000 deposit and had it scheduled, and I just got too busy. I sent them the money back and said, I can't do it. I just don't see how you guys are able to fit these things in with a publishing schedule and the teaching and all that stuff. So I'm terrible about it. I don't even accept it anymore. They say you're doing commissions. I've said, nope, I'm not going to be able to do it.
My whole thing is I only do commissions at the shows, because I can't do anything. I can't work on a children's book there. I can't record a class at a show. So, you know, there is some downtime at these things, and I might as well fill it while working. And I look at, you know, 9 out of 10 conventions I go to, I look at it as this is a work weekend. This is not like a chill and relax weekend. This, if I'm already putting all this time and effort to come out here to do this stuff, you know, and I'm not around my family and I'm not doing anything for me, then I'm going to fill in the rest of the time trying to get as much work done and get as much money out of the experience as I can. And then every once in a while I'll do a show where I'm like, okay, you know, I'll do half, or I won't do commissions this time, or I'll do half as many so I can just kind of enjoy this particular show and hang out with people. But for the most part, it's like, I'm here to work and I'm going to get some stuff done.
You're a better man than I am.
Well,
I'm going to relax.
I'm with Will. Jake works too hard.
But there is another difference. I would say the number of domestic beer sales versus wine sales would be a difference.
Yeah. Okay. So art fairs are for the 1%. Comic cons are for the 99%.
That's probably there's some truth to that. But before we move to the next topic, I do want to say, for those of you guys listening, to understand which one of those markets your work belongs in, because I did CTN with Will and Jake a couple of years back, and we weren't prepared at all, and I just kind of, you know, barely got some stuff together. I think I was selling like 5 or 6 prints and just hobbled this little booth together. But mm-hmm. my work just wasn't what they're looking for. Like Jake said, they wanted things that they recognize. And I can tell you the secret sauce, by the way, to Comic-Cons. Are you guys ready for this?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Take any character, any IP character, and turn it into a sexy girl version of that character. I'm not kidding. Yeah, maybe I'll do a slideshow. Because when I was at CTN, I took pictures. I just walked around. There's the sexy Little Mermaid. There's the sexy, you know, Tarzan and Jane girl. There's the sexy, I mean, the sexy version of, you know, Strawberry Shortcake.
Like, yeah, there's gender swapping too. So it'd be like a female Han Solo and, you know,
sexy.
Or like a female Boba Fett or a female Jabba the Hutt. I don't know. But a sexy, you know, sexy Jabba the Hutt. Ooh.
A couple of hacks would
hot
do
in here, like guys.
A couple of hacks would do like a cute version of characters.
Yeah, cute version. That's Will's. Will's cheap. Whole shtick.
It's such a cheap tactic.
No.
Hey, but he nailed it.
Man, you did nail it. So Will does cute versions of all these characters. So it'll be like the cute version of Game of Thrones characters. And it's the cute Joker and it's the cute Batman. And they're like babies, right? They're like little kids. So you can't, like, you couldn't go the opposite direction. You couldn't do like the old geriatric version
Although
of these characters.
I thought it would be.
Yeah, but who wants that?
Yeah, it wouldn't sell as well, but it would be funny.
It would be funny.
It would be funny for the window shoppers that aren't going to buy anything.
If you had the resources, you could do them all like that. Set up your table across the way just to get people's attention to buy your baby stuff. Yeah.
I will say this, that Will knocked it out of the park with that project, because he got it, there were so many advantages to what he did there. It was recognizable mm-hmm. characters. They're all very pleasing to look at. He started working in this pencil style, so he nailed that and got a book based on that, if I'm not mistaken. So he established a new style for himself, and he just kind of ran with the whole thing. Then he made it into a Kickstarter, made it into a book, made it into posters. I mean, it was just one thing that led to the next, and that's when I finally had respect for Will, because he took this idea. I mean, somebody else, a lesser person would have done one or two of these things, maybe three or four, but Will did one, and then he did two, then he did 100, and then he said, okay, where's this thing going to go? And now he's got the book, he's got the art fair stuff with it. I mean, it's all over the place, and then he's getting other work based on it. And all joking aside, it's amazing what he did with it.
Someone license some of the characters? They got a license to do Marvel or something, and they wanted to use your characters.
I've had a bunch of deals. So far they've either fallen through or they just haven't happened yet. But there are some pretty interesting ones, I should say. And I'm still fingers crossed on a few of them. But Lee, I thought you respected me for my froth skills.
Yeah, me and Will played disc golf. We're never going to speak of that again.
Golf skills.
No, Lee, a little known side factoid. Lee is like pro, right?
At the dumbest sport on the planet.
Pro at frisbee golf.
So here I am. And I'm thinking, well, he'll probably be pretty good. But I think I might be. I've thrown the frisbee at the family reunion. You know, like I might be a bold man. No, not even close. He hasn't seen frisbee golf skills.
You got to practice. You were pretty good. Will had some skills. I'll give him that.
Thanks.
All right, let's move on. You guys, so this is how our conversations actually go, whether we're recording them or not. So we've been going for about 47 minutes so far, and we're on topic number one out of my seven. So this oh, geez.
Okay.
We
this
just
might be
babble.
A two-part series, right?
Maybe. We can burn through some of these other ones a little quicker. This is the nuts and bolts of it, what you guys have been waiting for. Is there a list that we can give them on how to start? I've got kind of a starter point, but I'm sure you guys have things you can add as well. So how mm-hmm. does somebody start? They're listening to this and they're like, oh man, I've been thinking about that too. Or I've, you know, seen a couple of them, now I want to get into it. You want me to go through my A, B, and C, and then you guys can add to them?
Do it. Yeah, do it.
Okay. So step one, you guys are going to love this one, is go visit the shows. And when I say visit the shows, I mean as somebody who's doing research, not just as a fan who's running around buying stuff, although you can do that too, but like you need to just be in research mode. It's a little bit different. Take notes. You probably don't want to go with friends. You definitely don't want to go with family or your girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. This is like serious time where you're going to look around. Now, the beauty of this, I don't know if you guys have gotten a sense of this after all of our podcasts so far, but I love the business side of all this stuff. This, if you're a business like all three of us are, and you know most of our audience wants to be illustrators, these shows are tax deductible. Will going to Hawaii next week is tax deductible. Even in the research phase of it, it's tax deductible as long as it's kind of proven that you're going to go into that market or you're researching this market in a serious way. So what I love doing when we were researching art fairs is just find places that I really want to visit. I didn't go as far as Hawaii, but I picked really cool areas like Seattle and Bend, Oregon is a really beautiful place. Some Bay Area shows I went to, and just as a spectator, but I made notes. I talked to people. I asked, you know, you don't want to take up too much of an artist's time. I know Jake and Will probably have some horror stories with this as well, but you can go into the booth and ask a couple of questions. Don't linger and kill their time. What do you guys think about that as a step one?
Definitely. Yeah. Do your homework, research it. I would take your, take photos. Take a bunch of photos of all the different booths and see what's working, see what's not.
And to me, one of the most valuable things you can do is spend some time with the cringy people that are like newbies, that like you're going to be, and analyze why do you want to get away from them? Mm-hmm. Like why, you know, they're going to try to pull you in mm-hmm. and they're going to make all the wrong moves in trying to sell you their art. And it's important to reverse engineer that stuff.
That's a great point.
Same mistakes.
That's a great point. And likewise, the people who kill it, you'll see some booths that are just constantly busy. Of course, their work's going to be good, but look at how it's set up. Look at what their price points are. How are they selling the work? I mean, actually, how are they running it through a sale? Are they using a phone and a little credit card swiper? Are they using a real register? You know, just like all the little details. Pay attention. Do they have lighting? Where are they in the show? Do they have a corner booth or are they in the center? All these things are going to be really important details as you start to segue into your career. And likewise, like Will said, look at the people who don't have anybody in there. Is their booth too dark? Do they have too much? A lot of times people do what I call the yard sale or the garage sale, where they just pack their booth full of everything they've ever made in their life, whether they're a student or their fifth grade art project. And they have work even on the ground. That is like the biggest no-no ever. Don't put your work on the ground.
Space. I got to use it all.
Yeah. When you go into an art gallery, like a real art gallery, look, they're not filling their whole walls. A lot of times there's a lot of white space. They have a very select curated group. And that's how yours needs to be. It needs to be a collective group, not just everything but the kitchen sink. Those people always, and at least in my experience of watching them, they always fail.
Yep.
Good call. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, what's the next thing?
The next one. So you've gone to a show, you've written down some things, you've asked some people about their gear, you got a plan. You need to start making some inventory. That's going to be first. You can't do a show unless you have some stuff. Almost everybody's business that I know of that's an artist hinges on prints. There's a few people that only sell originals. That's a really scary proposition because the price point of originals tends to be a little too high. So prints are my bread and butter. I make about 60% of my income on prints at the shows. I know some artists, at the Comic Cons, it's all prints. That's how you are, Will, right? You sell in prints?
Yep. And the books. Prints and books mostly.
Okay. So you guys, so a newbie is going to start out probably with prints. I want to advise you guys in your initial research, if you're going to make prints, don't make color copies like at Kinko's or, you know, the corner store. You want to make sure your prints are what they call archival. If you're not familiar with that term, it just means that it's not going to fade after a year or two. Prints from Kinko's fade very, very quickly. They're not made to be around for a long time. So you want to get some higher quality stuff. Epson inks are archival. The Canon printers now are archival inks. So a lot of the inks that they're making just for startup level printers are archival. Make sure the paper's archival and use a good quality product.
So you're saying spend more money, and I totally agree with you. What would you say to the person who's like, I don't have any money?
You can't do this. There's startup costs. Yeah. I mean, you got to pay for a table. You got to pay for your inventory. You got to pay for travel.
So it's better to not do it at all or wait to do it until you have.
Here's the danger. I'm really glad you brought that up. This is a great topic. If you decide to go ahead and do it, just say, I don't have the money for that. I'm just going to go ahead and bang it out at Kinko's and sell it in a paper bag or whatever. So fast forward a year. Now you're back at the same show again. But the person you sold to last year, their print already faded. Or it got crinkled up because the paper was so bad or whatever. And so now they're going to be mad at you and you're going to start to get this reputation for people not wanting to buy work from you. A lot of my work, and probably a lot of Jake and Will's too, is people who bought one thing and then they bought another thing because they were happy with the first thing. So that's how you need to think is, I'm not just selling this one thing. I'm selling, this is the first in a long line of, it's a relationship you're trying to build, not just a quick sale.
I never predicted how much repeat business there would be. I would have bet highly against how much repeat business we get.
Yeah, so go big. I mean, you don't have to go huge in terms of cost, but at least make the stuff you put out there a high quality where you can stand behind it, because you are going to regret it if you don't. It'll all be worthless if you have cheap stuff.
Mm-hmm. But the thing about prints is they're like they have the lowest amount of overhead.
Mm-hmm.
Of anything you could sell. So you get a print made for, you know, a nice print for $1 to $4, right? And then you're selling them for anywhere from $20 to $40, depending on how big they are and, you know, how much color they are. So, like, you only have to sell five of them to make back your money, right? You know?
That's a great point.
How much you spend on prints.
And to go along with that, we have tried Six Ways to Sunday to figure out other things to sell that other people don't have so that we can be original and we can sell different things. And we always come back to, yeah, but they're heavy or they're hard to, they're bulky, so they don't fit in the van. Prints, they're the cheapest with the highest markup. They last forever. You can sell them at future shows because nothing happened to them. They didn't get damaged. And what else? They're just the, whenever we come up with other things like t-shirts or stickers and stuff, it's like per unit cost, those other things are always so much more. Like we tried t-shirts and then we found out how hard it is to stock the right size, the right style of shirt, the right color of shirt, it just doesn't work. Like people are there. They want prints. You are like everyone else because you have prints, but at the same time, that's mostly what people are looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. And most businesses, by the way, can only dream of the level of markup that a print is typically sold for versus its cost. They would
even
die
an
for
expensive
it.
One like ours are costing us. If we print enough of them now, we can get the cost down to about 60 or 70 cents for really good ones. That would, if you only ordered from the company we use, Press Media, out here in Utah, if you ordered 10 or 20, you'd get them for like $1.20 each. So, and if you can sell that for $20, the markup is insane. But they are twice as much as Kinko's or three times as much as Kinko's or something, you know.
That's still pretty cheap. Now, along that same thing, you know, going into my next one, which ties into that, is start small and work your way up. So if you are going to do prints, you don't have to do a print of every single thing you've ever made. You're probably going to want to do 5 prints maybe or 10 prints or something like that, and then just have a limited size available. You don't have to have 5x7s, 8x10s, 11x14s, all the way, you know, up through infinity sizes. You can just, I just sell 11x14s, and that's the only size I sell because it gets too hard to try to stock every single thing. And some people come in and say, oh, do you have this in 8x10? And then they're bummed because I don't, but whatever. I mean, like you can only do so much. I can't bring every option for every person. So I just said, I'm going to bring 11x14s, and that's been pretty good for me. Other people do 8x10s and maybe one or two sizes, but you can start small and you can work your way up. And then you start to see what thing people are interested in. Cause you'll probably, if you bring 10 prints to your first show, one of them is probably going to dominate the other ones. And you,
it's
then you look
80-20
at
20 rule.
Yeah.
But haven't you also noticed, Lee, that people will push to the size they didn't really necessarily want a lot of times and buy it anyway?
What do you mean?
I want an 8x10, but you only have it in 11x14. I guess I'll get it anyway.
They absolutely do. And by the way, you can steal from yourself along those same lines. When we had 8x10s, people would always buy the 8x10 over the 11x14, which is more expensive because they just want an image. And when I stocked cards, which were only like 4x6, they would buy the $3 card instead of the $45 print just because they just want the image. So I stopped bringing anything that was lower than the 11x14 print. Because I was stealing from myself.
This is my sticker argument. So I get a lot of people saying, I sell tons of stickers. And stickers are more expensive than prints. And so I look at their price point and they're selling tons of $5, not tons, but they're selling $5 stickers at the expense of a $20 print.
Right.
And I basically learned from Mr. Jed Henry. You know, we've mentioned him on here before, but he offers one size. And he's like, yeah, why would I sell something smaller and cannibalize a bigger sale? When they want this image, they'll fork over the money to get the bigger one.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's good. That's good. That's worth this podcast right there, just in that little tidbit.
But if you think about this the hockey stick, right? So you have the sharp upward part of the stick, which is your your prints, your high, you know, cost objects, your original art, you can make a lot of money over there, or you could sell 1,000 different small things and just make money on that long tail. So I think I've seen some booths where they'll have literally like 1,000 different little stickers or buttons or anything, and you can get 3 of them for $10, or, you know, 7 of them for $20 or something like that. And they'll do just fine selling off a ton of these little things. And then the next guy over is selling, you know, a $40 print, and they're just trying to move, you know, move one of those. So you have to think about, like, is your stuff appealing, you know, who does it appeal to? Does it, you know, is it more for a broader audience? Is it, you know, is it for people who are on a budget? And that's why, like Will said, just go and do it and figure out what's working and what isn't.
That's a good point, because there are different niche markets within a show. So, for instance, like mothers buy my work more than probably any other demographic. And then there are some friends that I have where it's the kids bugging their parents for money so they can get something at their booth. And so maybe a sticker does make more sense.
Can I use my Taco Bell analogy?
Yeah.
you can tell we're all teachers because we have a bunch of analogies. Yeah, right. I use this in class. if I'm going to work in the food service industry, say I've got to spend, you know, 6 hours at a restaurant, I can work at Taco Bell and I can make minimum wage, or I can work at, I never go to expensive restaurants, but Ruth Chris Steakhouse. And I can work there. Both places I've worked for 6 hours. But if the average tab is like, you know, $200-$300 at the steakhouse, I'm making tips on that. So I'm walking away with a ton of money more. Mm-hmm. Now, to bring that into the art world, I can spend, you know, a weekend selling 5,000 $1 items, or I can sell one painting for $5,000. I'd rather do the one painting. Right. So it's just how hard do you want to work? And then there's a sweet spot. I don't think you want to be the person selling a billion buttons.
Well, the other thing, though, is every sale is a person you've touched. So, you know, if you're going into this with a really long game mentality, which is what I do, is I'm getting emails from everybody and I'm building up an email list. And so then when I launch an online product, you know, a PDF download, or I don't plan on going to a con, I still have these guys' email, and I could just say, hey, it's nice to meet you at this show. By the way, I've got this new thing coming out. And then I don't even have to go to a show. I can just sell them something online.
Oh, that's so good. That's so good. So that's kind of the other side of that coin. And to speak to that, I've sold some people, like when I was doing the greeting cards, I sold them first a greeting card, and then the next year I'd sell them like 2 or 3 prints, and then the next year they buy original. So I agree that does work with what you're saying. So there's a sweet spot in there, I think. Cool. So along the idea of starting small and working your way up, I think comic cons are a little easier to do than art fairs, because art fairs are curated. Meaning when you want to do an art fair, you can't just say, okay, I'm going to do it. You got to apply for it. There's a series of 5 judges, and they either vote you in or out. And I get turned down for more than I get in, by far. If I want to do 10 shows a year, I need to enter 50 because I get turned down. Yeah. And so it's never know.
I will have to put rank on you just a little bit there, Lee.
Say it again.
Your earbud fell out. I will have to pull rank on you just a little bit. The cons are filling up to the point where there's waiting lists now.
Oh, so, okay.
But they're not juried. Like, I wish they were juried, actually.
Yeah, that would be nice.
But you can't just decide to do, like, say, Denver Comic Con. You've got like a 3 to 5 year wait. And they do look at the work. Apparently, they're trying to up the quality.
So, oh, that's awesome. I didn't know that. That's great. But you can start small, right? At the Comic Cons, you can do like a small table. Is that right? All the way up to a booth.
Yep. And you can start at smaller shows. And there are shows that you can just automatically get into.
Yeah. So I would definitely recommend that. Like, a lot of schools, elementary schools have shows. I mean, if you start paying attention to your local market, especially if you live in a major city, there's a lot of these shows that go on. And the main thing is just get in, and for your first show, try to get the smallest area possible. You don't want to be responsible for filling a 10 by 10 foot space. because that's a lot of work you got to have and a lot of infrastructure. So start small and bring like 10 products or whatever, and then you start to figure out which products sell, which products don't, and then you start to just slowly alter that. Now, if somebody wanted to do Comic Cons or conventions, how do you recommend they find them? Like if somebody's sitting there saying, "Hey, I'm ready to do it," where do they even find? Is there a list?
Yeah, there's actually a website. Maybe I can find it. We can put it in the show notes, but there's a website that has the schedule of almost every single one in the U.S.
I would say though, before going to that list, just check and see if there's one within an hour of where you live. And nowadays there pretty much is. So I would do the show, your home show first. And that way the overhead's low. You don't have to get a hotel. You can drive to it. You can carry all your stuff. And it's like just a sort of like training wheels for doing a show. And once you nail that, once you figure out how to do it there,
right there,
you can take your show on the road.
Mm. What is it?
ConventionScene.com.
Convention Scene. I haven't heard of that one. That's ConventionScene.com. Jake brought up a great point. The expenses of this thing. So you got your prints and you got your, say you got into the show, you still have to pay for getting there. You know, hopefully you got a van or something. A lot of people rent vans or U-Hauls or whatever. If you do a local show, like he said, you don't have to get the hotel. That's really expensive and you can make your own food at home and bring your own food. And so it's definitely advantageous to stay local until you get your market figured out and then start branching out. For the art fairs, if you guys are looking to get in, I would start with craft art fairs. The difference is the really high-end art shows are just art, like gallery-style stuff. There's some that are hybrids that are the craft market, Crafty Wonderland, if you guys look that up. Or there's quite a few. I'll put some in the show notes. But try to do those first. They're a little easier to get into when they're mixed with some kind of craft market. They're typically indoors. A lot of those are in the winter. Around Christmas is a great time to do it. There's two resources I want to give you. The Art Fair Sourcebook. I'll put this in the notes as well. If you guys go there, it has the art fairs by region, and it lists how many people are attending, what the average that they spend on, what the average they spend at the show is. There's whole demographics. It's expensive. Like everything with the art fair market is a little bit more expensive, but again, you're catering to a little bit more budget as well. So that's how you can get a listing of them. And then another one is Zapplication, Z-A-P-P, Zapplication. And if you go there, they just have, you can enter it in by region or by state or whatever, and it has every show in it. And you can actually apply to the shows at that on that website. So you guys got to try it out. It's pretty fun. So should we tell them some, do we have any horror stories and success stories we want to talk about?
Okay, so I'm an eternal optimist.
Let's hear it.
And I knew that when you print...
Now go.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah, ready.
I feel like an actor.
I know. Sorry, guys.
What's my line? Okay, so I'm an eternal optimist. And when I decided to pull the trigger and actually do my first show, I knew that the leverage or the price point per unit on offset printed prints would be much lower per unit than with color copies. And so I just thought, you know, I'm going to do this. I'll probably do well. Why not spend a bunch of money and get your prints offset? And so I ended up getting, I would not recommend anyone do this, but I got 1,000 of each print, and I had 23 different images.
23,000.
I got 23,000 prints that I couldn't even fit in my minivan, and at a cost of about $5,000. And I thought, but I will do this for a long time, and we will not, you know, and the price went down to 10 cents each. And so that was what I was thinking is like, you know, if I do this for years. Now, luckily, I've been doing it for years.
So you paid it back.
But the first show was, I made $1,500. So I was upside down $3,500 plus more upside down. That didn't include all the other expenses like the show and Luckily, it was a local show, but it could have gone really bad. What if nobody really wanted my work at all? And, you know, that's the eternal optimist in me. So it's not really a horror story, but it felt like a horror story when it was happening on the first show, because I had, you know, Jake is over here. I kept asking him, like, how much do you make in this last show? And he's like, 4,000 gross. And I'm like, wow. And how much do you make on this other one? 6,000. And how much you make at this other one? 8,000. And so I'm just like, well, you know, I might not be as good as Jake, but I can make some $4,000 at a show, you know, maybe three. If I make three, that's more than half of my expenses. I'll make it up in the next show. And I didn't even come close. And I was like, oh, this hurts. Now I have to do, now I have to do more shows. But no, we turned it around, and we just went to convention school from doing it. I learned all the mistakes that I did. Again, I've got the YouTube series on it, so I put all this in there. But now it's like, it's we can go to a show and know almost before we even leave, like, about how much we're going to make. And there's no, almost, it feels like there's zero risk now, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And now you're also doing stuff where you're like, you're trying out new ways to get people to come to the booth. So one of the most brilliant things I think you've done is you pay for $100 or $500 advertisement in the convention book that they put out. The what was it called? The guidebook?
The program.
Yeah. Yeah. And the advertisement says, you know, come to Will Terry's booth, and it'll have a picture of Jack Skellington. And it says, well, you explain it. It's your thing.
You're doing really good. I was like, I loved hearing your version of it. And so, yeah, basically come to booth number, you know, 1123 to get your free Jack Skellington print while supplies last. And we said, you know, we'll give out 100 or 300 of them a day or something. And we would, and I wasn't there when we did this. We've only done it once. We've tried to do it at other shows, and we've missed the opportunity of getting in the program, but we're trying to do it for Salt Lake right now. And, but basically Wayne would show up in this was in the Seattle Comic Con. He'd show up in the morning, and there was already a line at our table that was like 50 people long going down the row, waiting for him to get there in the morning. And that happened every day. He would give away another, you know, and these prints cost us, I think we paid something like $300 or something for 1,000 of these. So all it basically was an opportunity for him. It was like, basically the ad said, come to our booth and we'll give you a sales pitch on how you can spend more money, you know? So Wayne would just invite him and say, hey, it's half off if you want to buy anything, and you can come back, just show us the print. And then for the rest of the day, you can get something at half off. And it was our best show to date.
So wait, okay. So they show up at your table to get a free print. So already you've got, you know, 50 people, 20 people, whatever,
right,
waiting for you to show up, which if you've ever been to one of these, people don't wait at your table for anything.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So you've already got those people, and then they get their free print, and it might be like a smaller version of the bigger print.
It was smaller than what we normally sold.
Okay. But then it itself is a coupon for half off a future purchase.
Like, think about it. And come back later on, you know. But the crazy thing is, a crowd begets a crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And so the real gold is the fact that we have all this activity at our table, so that when they, you know, when other people are walking by, they see, well, what's going on over here? So it attracts even more people.
So you might do like the dead zones, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 11 o'clock in the morning. You might say, I'm giving away a print at these, you know, giving away 10 prints at this time.
We thought about amending that and saying every hour we'll give away 10 free ones to the first 10 people there. At the top of the hour.
Oh, that's so smart.
That's really cool.
Well, so that's okay. Not too bad of a horror story, I guess, ultimately.
No, it really felt horrible. I mean, the other part of that story is I forgot to bring sleeves for my art, so I was just handing people pieces of paper to people when they bought one.
Oh, dude, I got it worse than that. This isn't my actual horror story. But on that note, so my first show, so I'm selling all originals, and I sell this is when I, not that first one I was telling you guys about earlier, but when I actually had a booth full of originals, and somebody bought that first one, and I brought it down, and I'm like, I have nothing to give it to them in, so I gave it to them in a trash bag. So embarrassing.
You're looking at these other people sliding them in these, you know, these, yeah,
that was me,
slick plastic covers.
Presentation cases for originals. Some people have presentation cases made for the people who buy them. I mean, like, it's a custom deal. Oh, here's your trash. Here's your glad bag.
Here's the problem. We didn't go to business school. And so we're not, I think the most of us aren't like thinking about it like I'm starting a business. But really, when you do conventions or art shows, you're starting a business.
You're a store.
Yeah. That's why you do your homework first. Right. You go around, you take notes. Oh, that person bought an original.
Yeah.
Oh, they did this.
You make lists.
You know,
lists of the things that you're going to need.
Just look at presentation. Look at, you know, the wording that's used. One of the other things you're going to learn real quick is sort of convention etiquette. And what you'll have is, there's a term I learned from Brad Geiger, who's a comic book artist. It's called booth barnacle. So booth barnacle is anyone who hangs around way too long, kind of outstays their welcome.
They often have bad breath.
Well, they'll be sitting there talking to you, just unaware that there's people coming, looking at your stuff, wanting to buy something, and then leaving because they don't have access to you. They can't ask you a question. And so you're going to have to learn, how do you deal with those people? How do you get rid of them in a polite way? You know, my favorite tactic is talk, and then say, you know, as soon as they take a breath, "Well, it's so nice to meet you. Thank you for coming." Stick out your hand to handshake it. And that is like a very obvious cue that this is done. And usually something clicks in them. They're like, "Oh, that's right. I need to probably leave."
That's great.
Unless you don't get the normal human cues.
No. And you know, you never know if you're dealing with someone who's somewhere on the spectrum and they just don't understand.
Right. But now, Jake, everybody's going to be afraid to come and say hi to you. They're going to be like trying to leave as soon as they say hi.
They're going to be waiting for that moment where Jake busts out that move.
Yeah. If they get that, just feel honored. I'm paying close attention to them and how to get rid of them. No, here's the thing. I am happy to talk to anybody. And if nobody's at the booth, you know, I'll give you all the time you want, especially if you buy something from me, I'll give you attention. I'll answer questions, all that stuff. But I mean, primarily the reason I am at the convention is to make my money back and also not just make my money back, but to you know, to supplement my income for the month. Right. And so that's priority number one.
Yeah.
And, you know, if someone does need more time with me, you know, maybe we'll go out to lunch or something. I've done that before. People have, you know, can I sit down with you and treat you to breakfast? And can we talk about, you know, my career and if I have time and if there's an opening, yeah, I'll go have breakfast. I did that in Denver and talked to the guy for an hour about what he should do and where he should, you know, where he should go with his career. I don't mind doing that stuff, but you know, there's got to be a time and a place to do it.
Yeah. In terms of etiquette, watch out for wanting to bring your portfolio just into a booth randomly and start showing that artist the portfolio. That's kind of bad form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I understand the desire to do that, but,
So a lot of people do that. Do you think it's just a total no-no? Or
I think if you do want to do that, they need to bring the work in and just say, "Hey, is there a time I can schedule where I might be able to show you this work?" And if it happens to be, like Jake said, during a slow time, of course I'll say, "Yeah, let's look at it right now." I mean, that's mm-hmm. We're there to make money, but we're also there to talk with you guys and to meet yeah. people, other artists and patrons and mm-hmm. everybody. And that's the fun part. I mean, this is an isolating business. And so when I go to an art fair, I love talking to people. But just don't just shove it in their face and start going through it. Ask them if it's okay. And if not now, when?
Right. And there's been times where I've, I'm like, well, you know, we're going to be here for a bit. I'm looking at their stuff. You know, come here, just sit next to me. You could sit behind me and I'll look at it. And if someone comes, you know, you could sit beside me. And if someone comes, I'll deal with them and then I'll come back to you, you know. So I'm willing to work with people for sure.
I think that people should do the, what is the one main thing you think I should change in my portfolio? Mm. You know, so I think we talked about this in our critique podcast, didn't we? But basically that gives me permission to tell you something very specific, and it could be something very harsh. But you've given me permission and I can look for it really quickly. Like, what is the one most, if I have just one comment and I can get in and get out quicker and give you a pretty good value. Like, wow, this is the one thing that I should work
on. Great idea. So if you guys haven't heard that podcast we did about getting good critiques, go listen to that before you go as a patron to one of these things. Hey, Jake, what's your horror? Do you have a horror story and or a success story?
I'm trying to think any sort of, let's see. Yeah. Okay. So I decided for 2017 not to do conventions, just because they were taking a little too much time and I had to work on other stuff. So I took a year off, and then I remembered I signed up for Emerald City in March of 2018. And so I just wasn't in like convention mode thinking. And so I was like, well, I'm just going to pack all my stuff up and show up at this thing. And when I get there, the table that I had was like bumped up right against this wall. And my space would have been like facing a wall instead of facing like the convention, you know? And it was just like, it was really bad. So what I ended up doing was sliding the table out from a 90-degree corner to 180-degree flat. So it flush with the rest of the tables instead of rounding that corner and facing that wall. And I stuck the table out of, I guess, the barrier a little bit. And I was like, you know what? If anybody has a problem with this, then I'll fix it. But I'm sort of that mindset at these things, like you don't ask for permission. You ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
And even if you get in trouble, you still ask, like, please, you know, can we work something out? So people went the whole show, you know, nobody said anything as I was like sticking out of the way of where I was supposed to be, whatever, it worked. So that was that. But then I had brought this foam core and I made this sort of foam core display, what would you call it? Just a display structure to hang my prints on. And this thing kept falling over. It kept like, it was taped together. It just looked really ghetto. And the whole time I'm just like, I can't believe like this is my presentation. It was this thing that was taped together and it was warped and it was humid. So things were warping on it and tape was unsticking. And anyways, the show overall was really good, but it was like, it was just, those are the kinds of things you got to roll with and you deal with at every different con. There's just something like that that you got to deal with.
That's a great story. I mean, it does highlight that there's always some variable that no matter how much you try to plan, there's some little weird thing. And you don't know where you're going to be a lot of times at the show, or even if they give you a map beforehand, you kind of don't know really what it's going to be like until you get there. And it's always
you don't know traffic patterns. You don't know if it's busier on one side of the floor, you know, as opposed to other sides. So it is a little bit of sometimes it is a little bit of a gamble doing these shows.
A total gamble. And you learn as you go. Like one year I was the first or second booth right as people entered. And this was basically a long hallway type design. So it was just one avenue that people went down. And I was like, awesome. I'm right in the beginning. I'm the first one they're going to see. So they're going to be fresh and ready to go. Oh, it was the worst. Because they're just like, well, I haven't seen anything. I can't buy anything yet. I need to go walk around. And then they go halfway through the show, they buy a couple things, and then they're out of money. I mean, it was off. It was terrible. So you just learn those kind of things.
And I think at comic conventions, being in the beginning is often really good because they're only spending, they're going to buy a bunch of different things for, you know, $5, $10, $20 each. I've heard people do really well. Because there's the wave of, I've been waiting in line and I just want to get
something. They're excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
there's that. There's also usually like Friday is people. Usually Friday is people who are there all 3 days, right? And the Friday is the day where they just kind of scope everything out. They don't spend any money, and they might come back Saturday or Sunday.
Huh. Yeah, so that's the same true at art fairs as well. Yeah. My horror story, oh my gosh, it hurts my stomach to even think about it. It's so,
oh, I know what you're
it's so
say.
Bad. It's so bad. So I talked about this in the beginning of the show. You guys won't appreciate this until you do one of the shows with how much little stuff you have to take care of. Like, do you have receipts? Do you have the walls that you're going to put your paintings on? Do you have the hooks to put the paintings on? I mean, you're basically building a whole store in a day. And so there's just so much to take care of. So I was setting up for the show and I'm running around like crazy. Just, you know, the clock's ticking. There's a big crowd outside. They haven't let them in yet. And so I'm running around like crazy, going back and forth to my van and trying to get the booth built. And somebody comes running up next. This is back when I kept my cash, because you got to have cash just on you. You can't leave it in the booth because somebody it could get stolen. So I had it in a fanny pack. So lame, right? Just wearing a fanny pack is so lame anyway. Somebody came running up to me. She's like, hey, you dropped a couple dollars. You dropped some money. And I was like, oh my gosh. I turned around. She handed me a couple of bills. And I was like, oh, that is awesome. I'm so glad you did that. And so I went to put the bills in the fanny pack. And the fanny pack was tipped over and unzipped. And it had the entire proceeds from my last show. $3,000 had blown away in the wind. The show, and I was like, oh my, you know, it's that moment to just wait, you know, if I could do the cinematic effect where the whole world kind of spins and I'm just like, wait, what? You know, I'm trying to be in denial for the first few minutes. And then it's just like, there's no way to, I've got the police involved and I'm running around, but it's cash. Somebody just had a great weekend on me. And it was so hard to get over. Cause that was before the show even started, first day. And so the whole show that was waiting, you know, weighing on my shoulders. And I considered it now just a kind of a stupid fee, because I wasn't handling the money in a professional way. I think it wasn't a good long-term solution, and I got penalized for it in the worst way possible.
Stupid tax. Yeah. I've had that before where I had gotten the day's money, which was a couple $1,000s, and I was like, well, I'm going to hide this in my bag here. And then I had forgotten that I'd done that. And so for like a half a day, I was just like, oh my gosh, someone stole my money. And I was just like in the worst mood. And then as I was cleaning things up at the end of the day, I found it where I hid it. And I was like, oh, okay, good.
So Lee, did you check all the pockets of your fanny pack? Maybe there's a pocket in there.
Well, somewhere. That's actually what the problem was. I didn't know that the fanny pack had two zippers. So when I was putting it on and strapping on, I zipped a zipper, but it wasn't the one with the money in it. That was my snag. Anyway, I have a full on.
You're just running a mile a minute. You're not even looking to see how many zippers there are in your bag. You're just go.
That's what you get if you wear a fanny pack. You shouldn't wear a fanny pack. Now I have a actual cat, like I said, that cash register that makes the ding. That was all prompted by this moment, and it has a lockable key and a, you know, cash drawer.
That's pretty smart. Yeah, I use a fanny pack actually. Yeah. So
zip it up.
It works. It works for me because I like having it on my person. But I know that there's two zippers and I zip them both, so it hasn't been a problem.
Yeah. All right, I think that's going to do it for now. I do want to. There's one more section, but we're just out of time. So maybe we'll write it up for the notes. I did want to go over the gear that we all use, you know, from all the way from printers to ordering the bags for the prints and products to the tents and the print bins and all that stuff.
You know, honestly, that probably makes boring podcasting content.
Totally.
So let's just type it up and we'll put it in the show notes.
That's better. That's better.
Okay.
All right, let's take us out.
Take us out. All right, you have been listening to the 3-Point Perspective podcast. Thank you for joining us, everyone. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com. All three of us teach classes there, and it's just a great website for you to learn your fundamentals. Also, you know, for beginning artists and for more intermediate artists, there's some really specific classes to help level your work up and find ways that you can improve. And then from time to time, we also offer live classes. So you can get one-on-one critiques from us at these live classes. So go to the website, get on the email list there, and you can find out when these live classes are happening. I'm going to be teaching one on how to draw everything. It's going to be like 4 or 5 weeks long, 5 or 6 weeks long, and with assignments, and I'll be helping you with your assignments and stuff like that. That's svslearn.com. Our hosts have been Will Terry. You can find his work at willterry.com, and on Instagram, it's at willterryart. Lee White, who you know, ran the show today and gave us all this information on everything. Awesome, awesome job today, Lee. You find his work at leewhiteillustration.com and follow him on Instagram at leewhiteillo. Have you gotten any more Instagram followers from since this podcast has launched?
I am. I'm around 10,500.
Nice. That's awesome. Because you just started it like a year ago, right?
Yeah, about a year ago.
So how to get your first 10,000 followers is...
Start a podcast.
There you go. all right. I'm Jake Parker. You can find me at mrjakeparker.com. And on Instagram, I'm at Jake Parker. All right. If you like this episode, please share it around. Subscribe to it on iTunes and leave a review over on iTunes. We love reading those. We love knowing what you guys think of this show. If you're wanting to join in on this particular discussion, want to ask more questions or share your experience with doing art fairs and cons, log on to the svslearn.com forums where we have posted a thread just for this episode. So yeah, chime in over there. Let us know your thoughts. All right, everybody. Thank you and see you next time.